You'll notice I've changed my title somewhat since I originally bit off this particular presentation. I did that for one very clear reason. I haven't got time in 15 minutes to rehearse 175 years of political, social, and healthcare philosophy for an audience who will know bits of it far better than I do, but none of it in its entirety to form a structured argument. I also need to start off by making a few clarifications. My background is in public health practice. I am not a public health legislator. I am not a public health ethicist. I don't have the time to spend long hours rehearsing and reviewing a lot of the literature to try and work out how what I feel in here, in my heart, actually is reflected within a political, philosophical, or a legal-ethical structure. And yet that's what we do. We do. We do every time. But the problem is, we use language which isn't necessarily consistent between us. So if I was talking to any ethicists in the audience, have we got any ethicists in the audience? Phew, that's one group of people I'm not going to annoy. Any public health legislators in the audience? Good, another group of people I can't annoy. But it's not just about the race word that we have to avoid or deal with. It's about what we mean when we say law, or ethic, or value. Because value is a very, very difficult word. If my usage differs from yours, please bear with me. It could be that we're being divided by a common language, and it's not English for once. My paper is a reflection. I cannot, in the basis of the 13 minutes that now remain to me, actually deal with an argument based on that 175 years worth of development. What I can do is try and explore what that heart and head and practice actually means and try and derive some thoughts towards a values base for global public health. That was the thing, global public health. I'll come on to that in my last slide. My starting point is very simple. Some of you will recognize the opening sentence to Krieger and Burns' seminal paper from 98 on the spirit of 1848. Social justice is the foundation of public health. Hands up who believe that. Hands up who haven't thought about it. Hands up how many actually realize that when you were saying you espouse that, you actually are looking at all of that qualification as well. I'm not expecting you to read it. Those are the subordinate clauses that you've adopted when you say social justice is the foundation of public health. I'm not sure what that really means. And I kind of guess most of us would spend the next day or two picking out all of those subordinate clauses and working out what it means. So let me try and make it simpler for you. Let's just consider social justice. This is the Rawls and Kelly statement on distributive fairness, distributive justice, social justice. I've picked out from the 300 and odd pages the one quote that seems to capture best what we say when we say in public health, social justice. The fundamental idea in this conception of justice, that's justice as fairness, is the idea of society as a fair society of social cooperation over time from one generation to the next. Great. Fundamental idea. Sorry, I actually count fundamental to mean one, and unfortunately they go on and then add two further fundamental ideas to qualify the first fundamental idea. And that it's a political conception of justice for a democratic regime. That social justice operates within democratic regimes. It's about public health, guys, on a global basis, Is that therefore a good basis to jump off for a value for global public health? Question. And the idea of citizens as free and equal persons, we'll come back to that, we'll hold on to that. Those engage in cooperation as free and equal persons, and the idea of a well-organized society regulated by a public conception of justice. In other words, just social justice is because being socially, we can be just by being social and socially fair. Now, admittedly, that kind of makes my head spin. Because there is a real risk we might actually go into a circularity there. We're being fair, therefore fairness is clear. There are other ways which we can conceive social justice definitions. Those of you who've read extensively the work of Larry Gostin and Madeleine Powers will be familiar with this restatement of social justice as distributive fairness. But fundamentally, it's still saying effectively the same thing. We are just because of how we act in fairness, and if that's the basis for public health and global public health, we have to think quite carefully what that means for the practice of public health. Now, I actually have this feeling that public health people are simpler than political and social philosophers. I think they're simpler because they want to do things rather than think about explaining why it is we do them. And I have one very good piece of evidence for that. Look at the size of our public health definitions. Okay? We're simple people, which is good. I like simple. Definition at the top is Roger Dettles and others. This is actually the fourth edition's definition. It's actually pretty much the same as the fifth edition's definition. It's about the process of mobilizing and engaging local, state, national, international resources to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. Very active, very focused, levels-based, about the business of effectiveness. Those of you in the audience from the UK will recognize the 1998 Aitchison report. Definition, the science and art of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health through the organized efforts of society. Organized efforts of society, good. We've got some social justice language in there, but it's still simple. It's still active. It's still doing. Are we really therefore saying that social justice and public health are one and the same thing if we try and compare these different definitions? And yet, somehow, we're trying to say public health is an affective arm of social justice, yes? Is that what we've actually just said? Some people would argue so. Back in 1976, Beaumont was actually looking at the notion of an ethical framework to determine public health actions as justified. My interpretation of his work, not his. But fundamentally, he's actually saying it's not about activity. So hang on, we said action, but maybe not. It's about a way of doing justice. So it's not what you do, it's the intent behind how you've done it. That social justice happens because you intend it to be fair. You don't do it to be fair. You do it because you intend it to be. Now, what he actually argued was you have to approach that by creating a new model. Have you noticed how good we are at creating new models? I actually think navel-gazing should be one of the great core competencies of public health. Because we do it. We do it all the time. The first reference to the new public health, as Alex told me earlier on today, was coming out in 1901. The new public health. Great. Brilliant. It has to be new. It has to be forward-looking. And this was Beaumont's view from the 1970s, that what we really were in the business of was controlling the hazards of the world, preventing death and disability through organized connective action and that notion of shared distributive responsibility where burdens and benefits actually needed to be balanced. And it was possible for a burden for one individual to actually be permissible to allow a wider benefit. Okay, The Rose Paradox on prevention is there writ large in an ethical principle. These are dependent clauses, I should add. You go from the top to the bottom. They follow through. They are not individual actions. And yet, we treat them as so. We're in the business of control, prevent, organize, collective action, protect. We're still in the business of acting. Where's intention? More importantly, where's the value? Now, we can actually leave it at that point. And most discourses that I've read actually do. We look at domains of public health, and I'm very embarrassed to see one of the authors of this paper in the audience. I apologize for the bastardization. But it doesn't really matter. I can actually describe in social justice terms every single one of those actions up there, or beliefs or outputs from whether we're looking at health protection, health promotion, or health services. It's a part and parcel of the business of being in public health that we act. And I can give you a social justice, a fairness dialogue for all those actions. But was that my intent? Now, in Scotland, where I'm from, we also have a prisons health system. And we're very proud of the fact that we're trying to be, in terms of our public health strategy, socially just. We actually put it into press. We said, we are going to create a socially just society within Scotland, and health is part of that social justice approach. If you go to the original statement of that in health terms, a public health strategy called Towards a Healthier Scotland, it sets it explicitly within social justice terms. Here's one of its benefits. In Scotland, we took the WHO declaration from Moscow on the nature of the relationship between prison health and a public health system. We took the work of the Health in Prisons Project within the European WHO region and have translated it through into policy imperative in a document, notice, called Equally Well. Remember I said we'd come back to that word equally. How does it work? Well, Moscow Declaration says prison health is a public health system. It actually has to operate as an integral part of that system within the country, otherwise you're not doing your jobs. And that in doing that, you are actually recognizing a marginalized group within your society at a point of contact that matters. How many of the people you see in prisons are the difficult to reach in any other setting that you want to reach them? They're not in prison. They're there. We can do things. I might come back to that a little bit later. And we can take a very broad approach to wider determinants of socio-economic, socio-cultural circumstances of lives of marginalized individuals and actually translate those into health promotion, health prevention activities of the type that Jose was talking about very extensively in Spain, and put them into practice. And put them into practice not just within the prison context, because remember, this is a universal healthcare system. We can actually do it into concepts of through care and aftercare. Equally well, as a policy document of the Scottish Government says, there's no difference between what happens in prison and what happens outside. If we can spot a difference in the services you provide, you've got a problem, and we're going to make sure that you put it right, Mr. Health Authority. Now, what that means is we've got socially just action. We're doing things about marginalized people. But has that really given us a notion of what values and what the value base that we're actually being driven towards here? I can actually see this purely in economic terms. I can take actions such as anticipatory care, actually trying to identify early in disease progression points of contact with individuals where if I intervene early, it'll be cheaper for me to provide a universal healthcare response than waiting until they get ill. Is that a value for social justice or is it an economic value? Is it an economic value? I can look at through care and aftercare addiction services, but hey, I've got a problem with that. In my system, I might actually find that it's better to be in prison to get access to detox and then through care and aftercare support when you come out of prison than it is when you're in the community and you're hard to reach. Equality in this context flows out from prison to the wider community and is a challenge as much as from the community in. America may have a first step towards an insurance-based healthcare system for a much broader population, but actually some of those things that insurance system will cover for individuals outside of the prison actually will happen inside of the prison now because it's part of the way in which that prison healthcare system functions, because there is a responsibility. As public health people, we have values and beliefs, and we're constantly trying to codify them. But we can't codify them, in my opinion, by our actions. We cannot say that because we have acted justly, that was really our intention. And I would contend, in my reflection on this, that I want to know that my intentions are consistent with my actions, rather than them being inferred by my actions. And I think in part that's why the APHA Leadership Society took the opportunity of trying to codify a set of values and beliefs. If you've not seen this document, download it from the website. Go and look at it. Test your own heart how far this actually works for you. But don't be confused. They're not values. Their belief statements. I think, having spent considerable time looking at this, that I can only identify two core values that I really want to be judged by as a public health practitioner. It's whether or not I am seeking a state of fairness for individuals, communities, and populations from which their health may flow. Equality is not about health, it's about fairness. And if my intent is to be fair, health will be a consequence, not necessarily a direct action. And secondly, I want to seek a state of health that's held in common by individuals and communities and populations, irrespective of where they are, and irrespective of the setting in which I have contact with them. Equality and mutuality. Those actually are potentially global values. They are things that move beyond simply statements of belief or practice in a particular jurisdiction or ethical framework. There's something which can capture intent, but they're also something that can actually guide action. In relation to prison health, Christopher Hamlin, who some work you'll have read, argued in relation to the prison reform movement in the UK in the 18th century and to an extent in America in a similar time, that it was actually the forerunner of public health. But it did so as an unusual coalition of reformers, from utilitarians such as Bentham, through to the types of evangelical Christians, the William Wilberforces, who were looking to effect a redemption. His word, not mine, a redemption. Such coalitions would be crucial to the public health movement of the 19th century. Perhaps most important, prison reform like Victorian public health, and I would argue prison reform and 21st century public health, is not mainly reactive to the existence of disease. It's a visionary movement towards the production of a new kind of person and a new kind of society. That was 175 years ago. I think we've got some unfinished business to deal with. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for any comments or questions.
Gone a day.
That very thought-provoking piece. Very philosophical.
That's what I was told to do.
Yes.
Hi, Nancy. I thought it was fabulous.
Thank you, Nancy. Well, that's helpful.
Especially the last part that you got to about those principles of equality and mutuality. Because to me, they fit in with the human rights-based approach. They address the question of empowerment of the people that we work with. And it does bring a question of values as opposed to just the practice of public health, which can be very effective, but not necessarily change.
Absolutely, and I think if I'm adding anything to this debate, it's moving us away from action as being sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient as a value, and that's the important bit. That's the important bit. That's what Bentham really understood. It's what Chadwick fought for, and that's what actually we may have lost out in our need to understand effective intervention rather than understanding intention and effective intervention.
Oh, get you there, didn't you? I'm right
Thank
behind.
You.
I'll follow you in a minute. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Excuse me, do you see a difference then in the foundations of public health and the foundations of harm reduction?
I think harm reduction is a tool that we use within a public health practice. If we accept that there are those individuals who, for whatever reason, are unlikely to be able to self-generate benefit from their own actions, then within that organized society, harm reduction may be one of those areas where you allow a disbenefit to the individual in some area, which is providing a greater ability elsewhere for benefit to occur. Whether the individual's harm minimization is directed toward them, but also with a consequence of a wider public good, is actually an issue for ethicists to work through. But do we offer a needle exchange because we want that individual to stop injecting, or do we want them to stop actually sharing dirty kit and spreading a bloodborne virus? Think through it in terms of your individual as recipient and your individual within community beyond, and you might get that kind of separation.
I guess if you think of harm as in terms of disadvantage, then of course disadvantage, fairness, all values come in that way. Depends on how you define harm, I guess, but clearly it's disadvantage. Any other comments or questions?
Thank you very much. We have got another
presentation. There are more people. let's move on from that. Thank you for that. Was excellent. But public health is more than a community. It's also, as I say, it is a movement, and it's got many voices, many constituencies, many perspectives. And a crucial group amongst those are the non-government organisations, the public health associations. And now we're going to hear from Dr. Selwyn Hodge, who's chair of the Royal Society for Public Health in the UK, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the potential role of the non-government sector in this whole area. Thanks, Selwyn.
Thanks, Alan. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to apologise firstly because my presentation is going to be fairly short and rather disconnected at times, because the intention was that my chief executive would have been here presenting. Unfortunately, he went to a WHO conference on health promotion in Nairobi and came back with H1N1, swine flu. So I don't know whether there was a connection there between public health and real health, but certainly I'm now standing in. So I apologise for no slides and some fairly short and cryptic comments. Let me start with my views about what NGOs are, because we hear the term bandied around, and I'm not sure whether the definition in the States is the same as the definition in the UK. But basically, I see these as not-for-profit organizations. That's one group of NGOs. They're often groups that are charitable in their nature, so charities and foundations and so on. But they can equally include faith groups, and certainly within the UK, we would include churches and other faith groups as part of that NGO movement. Collectively, they're involved in things like policy, advocacy, working with individuals, and of course, raising funds, particularly in foundations. Across the world, there must be literally thousands of NGOs, all ploughing their own furrows, all doing their own things, come in various sizes, various guises, they have different aims, different objectives, different governance, and it's a myriad of people all doing good things, or at least thinking they're doing good things, because they're part of organizations that profess to do good things. That's why so many people are happy to give money to charities, because they see charities as actually being a good thing in themselves. They very rarely question what charities do. I'm quite surprised at that. People will happily put money into collecting tins because NGOs overall are seen by the public as a good thing. Well, why? Well, in many ways, it's because they prefer NGOs to government. They see government as being very controlled, very contained, very political, having a set of objectives which not necessarily are conducive to every individual, maybe to society, and that's a debate that Phil and I might have. But in terms of the NGO, they are seen as having that charitable way forward. And therefore, people tend to trust NGOs more, perhaps, than they do trust government. In that sense, they're much more acceptable, and I suppose in many people's eyes, they're less judgmental. Government they see as judgmental in various ways, taxation in terms of legalities and so on. Lots of NGOs are less judgmental. They're there to help individuals and communities rather than to set up for whole populations very often. Generally, they're less bureaucratic. There's often a more rapid response as a result of that, and we can see that in the way charities can respond to crises across the world. A good example was the tsunami a few years ago, where it was the NGOs who got in very quickly, followed by government organizations much later on. It's a value of organizations which don't have that huge structure of having to organize themselves. They also, of course, in public eyes, are campaigners and advocates. They are the people who criticize government. They are the ones who actually say, well, this is what we should be doing. This is a fault in society. Let's do something about it. So in that way, NGOs are acceptable. They have good, positive strands. But there's often a lot of negatives to NGOs. Many of them are very small. They don't have much capacity to actually do what they profess to do. They can be very disorganized. They tend not always to want to work together because there's a competition. Possibly it's competition for funding or it's competition for role. That's something certainly which can limit the way in which NGOs can operate. They often overlap as well, and it's not clear why, and this is an issue which was raised many times by the UK government, why there were so many NGOs in health. Surely they could all come together. Why do we want six or seven bodies that are really doing the same thing? Confuses the public, confuses government. Well, it's because people like to belong to the organization they belong to. And if you mention merger, people immediately stand up and say, well, I'm not sure I really do want to merge. There's often a lack of capacity as well, both in terms of the ability to carry out work and also the skills of the workforce themselves. And unfortunately, many NGOs are still very dependent on government, particularly for funding. We find that in the UK, that many NGOs can only carry out their functions if they have government support. And that tends to then make those NGOs less independent, of course. And as a result, they can lack authority. And it's a difficulty when NGOs are working across the world that other governments don't necessarily accept those NGOs as having authority to enter and work with their populations. So basically, out of all that come two needs. One is much more cooperation between government itself and NGOs, not in the way that the government controls the NGOs, but that there's a real partnership. Governments find that very difficult. They like largely to be in control, particularly if they are funding those NGOs. They want their result to cost to count against the bucks that they've put in. That causes problems in terms of how much independence those NGOs can have. There's also a need to coordinate more the work that NGOs do between themselves and to ensure that there is that sort of overlap which allows productivity rather than conflict. I mentioned that in the UK, there was an issue about the number of NGOs in health that existed. And so the government decided, through the Department of Health, that health NGOs would be encouraged to come together to some extent and set up what is known as an NGO forum. And my organization actually hosts that forum in England in the UK. And that has proved valuable in that it does allow a forum for discussion. And it might be a model which we need to develop perhaps more across the world. So let's come down to some more basic practicalities. I'm basically a practitioner. My background is in education. I was a director of education for a local authority in England. And one of my responsibilities as a director of education was for the traveller families which came into our area in the UK. And by traveller families, we mean gypsies, to give a colloquial term, possibly Roma, and itinerants from various parts of the country. But basically, they were traveller families. Families that were very marginalised by society. Extremely marginalised, and really, if we're honest, not through their own wish or through their own actions. These are people who have a lifestyle which they have developed over many years, but it's a lifestyle that many people do not favour, certainly in the UK. So there's a lot of harassment for those families. There's a lot of stress and confrontation resulting from the way in which people view those families, and that goes very much into the school context for children. They're an alienated group in the UK. There's very little real mention of traveller families anywhere, unless there is a problem, and then you find that they're actually acknowledged as existing, only because they are causing problems. They are a very marginalised group. They're not a large group. Therefore, they have not very much of a voice. But nonetheless, they are a marginalised group of families, not just of the individuals, but of whole families being marginalised. As a result of this, the children have very poor educational standards. They don't always like to go to school. Their schooling often ends at 11 when they, in England, when they transfer to senior schools. They don't then carry on with their education. They have huge health problems. They have low life expectancy. They have a lot of cardiovascular disease, COPD, because of lifestyle. I mean, it is part of something that health promotion needs to address, but they are hard to reach. They have many early pregnancies and often pregnancies that are difficult and not managed well by the NHS. In England, because they don't always want to approach people working within the NHS. Quite understandably, they worry about authority figures, they worry about their situation with their families, and particularly if there's any issue about their children being taken into care. And this was a huge, huge problem within the educational system. So, just to go a little bit further into this, because obviously, we needed to do something about these children. They were part of the locality alongside all the other children. And we're talking from birth through to adolescence. The key was, we found, to win their trust, to show that we weren't there to break up the families, to say, we don't like your lifestyle, we're going to make sure you live in a house, not in a traveling van, and that basically We want to support you and your family and improve your education and your health and your wellness and your lifestyles that you want. And we found that, interestingly, we did put in workers to support the families, and these workers often got trust, and they weren't health professionals. We found it was better to have generalists working with the families on their problems rather than a health worker, an educationalist, and a social worker all coming in at different times saying different things. But interestingly, the most influential group on the traveller families was the Catholic Church, because virtually all of the ones that we had in that area were very committed Christians to the Catholic Church. Now, I'm not making a religious point here. This was a fact of their religious belief. And one of the most influential people with those families was the local priest. And working with the priest allowed us much more access into those families than we would have got otherwise. The children went to schools that in England are called Catholic schools. They are schools that are controlled by the Catholic Church. They're part of the state system, but the schools are run by the Catholic Church. And again, the families had a lot of confidence in the teachers in that school because the priest was the head of that school, basically, in terms of the governance, and they accepted the view of the teachers. And that was a way in which we were able not only to raise educational standards, but also to promote health. Because that was the way in which children were able to communicate with their families more about their health needs. The lesson for me, which I really want to communicate at this point, and I'm coming to an end, I'm conscious, Alan, I've only five minutes left. The lesson I want to leave is that basically we learned to use the most appropriate people to intervene with those particular groups. We didn't set up a bureaucracy. We didn't stand on ceremony and say, oh, well, this is a health issue. It's the responsibility of the health department. It was getting the right people to work and to intervene where appropriate. And I'm not saying that those interventions were ones that we imposed, because if you know traveller families, they won't accept imposition anyway. And what we did was to say, well, look, we'll help you if you want the help. We very much said that basically we were there to support whatever needs they had. But out of that, of course, the health promotion, the educational promotion, and the integration, because one of the things we wanted to do was to try to integrate them more into society, not to remove their lifestyles, but to allow them to feel that they were more acceptable within mainstream, that they weren't simply a marginalized group. Because, coming back to an earlier comment, many of the parents in particular had severe mental health problems due mainly to stress and to the way in which they were unable, particularly the men, to cope with the problems in their families and the fact that they weren't, in their view, supporting them well. And I leave that little cameo with you as an example of how NGOs can work. And that was a strange NGO. Perhaps many of you would never have thought of that NGO. And I'm certainly not, as I say, professing a religious view here that we should all become part of a church and that's the way forward. It's just an example of an NGO that actually met the needs of that particular organization well and helped that group of people to become more self-substantial. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Sylvan. Thank you very much. Very good. Well, we are running a bit short of time, sadly. But before we probably won't have time for panel discussion after all. But
we'll take any questions. But, since we're running short, I'm happy to talk to anybody at the end if you want that.
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Sylvan. We'll probably have time. We probably have time for one or two questions. But I do want to leave a bit of time just to invite Dr. Alex Gatherer here, who is the architect of today's session and who is an advisor to the WHO Healthy Prisons Project, just to say a few words about the need for gathering momentum in the public health movement. We're a global organization, we're a global movement in public health. We can provide a powerful voice, but we do need to organise and get together on this and to do something about the many injustices so we can make a big difference with the big decision makers. And this is where an organisation such as the World Federation of Public Health Associations could play a really powerful part as a global public health organisation to actually pick up this agenda of marginalised people and do something about it. And there's a draft resolution in the offing. And Alex, if you'd like to tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Alan, we're running out of time, but you've said it very nicely. Thank you very much. One of the great men that I sat at his feet and listened to, he said one of the roles of public health was constantly to revise what is unacceptable. And I think we've come to the stage where it is unacceptable that public health neglect the socially marginalised. Coming out of this afternoon's talk, you'll see how in Europe we have Spain leading Europe and public health gaining from what they are doing in prisons. We have Corey and others here pointing out that even in this great country, there is a need for this sort of approach. So, somebody mentioned earlier on the Global Watch 2, Report 2, pointing out that the governance of public health globally is weak at the moment. So what some of us are really keen to do is to bring in the world, the third sector, the World Federation. We think they have, with the cooperation of WHO, with suitable external funding, we think they have an opportunity of leading a global movement for improving the health of the socially marginalised. Now, if you agree with that, and if you're in a local health, if you're in a public health association, do indicate your support at the breakfast meeting later this week. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Alex.